in the sugarcane fields southwest of Ford Island, in the Manoa Valley northwest of Honolulu. A man could spot them by the rising sun sewed on their backs, or by the red patch on the left breast pocket, or by the rising sun shoulder patch. In any case, they were wearing blue coveralls. At Kaneohe, Mess Attendant Walter Simmons lost no time taking off his own blue dungarees. Orders were to change to khakis, but Simmons and most of the others had none. So they boiled vats of strong coffee, dipped in their whites, made khakis that way. Next report, the Imperial Marines landing on the west shore were in khaki. All hands changed to whites. Later, the force landing to the east was in white, back to blues. These were not men who had lost their heads. They were acting on the best information available. An official Army circuit monitor to Kaneohe reported sampans landing troops at the Navy Ammunition Depot, transports to the north, 8 enemy battleships 70 miles away. The Navy's harbor circuit was just as active. On the Vestal, radioman John Murphy logged in messages that Japanese troops were landing on Barber's Point, paratroopers dropping in Nuuanu Valley, Honolulu's water supply had been poisoned. Later, some radiomen felt the Japanese must have used Army and Navy frequencies, filling the air with false reports. But the outgoing logs of the various official message centers show that most, if not all, of the traffic was authentic. 11:46, from Pat Wing, enemy troops landing on North Shore, blue coveralls, red emblems. 11:50, COM-14 to SYNCPAC, parachutists landing at Barber's Point. In the present frame of mind, small incidents were easily misinterpreted and then exaggerated. The helm firing at the midget quickly became a Japanese task force bombarding the shore. When Fort Kamehameha, under the same illusion, began firing at the helm, that just proved it. It was the same with the paratroopers. Lieutenant Dickinson and Ensign McCarthy, bailing out of their flaming planes, were quickly spotted as 200 enemy soldiers. And once the idea was planted, the power of suggestion did the rest. Honolulu Police Headquarters got a frantic call that parachutists were landing on St. Louis Heights. Sergeant Jimmy Wong called for a National Guard company and sent up Patrolman Albert Wan. The guard never arrived, but Wan got there, armed with a .38. Luckily, all he found was a kite dangling from a tree. Even more frightening reports were now pouring in. The local Japanese were rising, it was said, and 5th columnists were on the loose. Sergeant Wong got a call at 10:08 a.m. that two Japanese with a camera were on Wilhelmina Rise. He sent a squad car, found only a couple out walking. McKinley High School reported saboteurs. Two pedestrians happened to be passing the ROTC building. But the stories spread faster than they could possibly be disproved or checked. On the seaplane tender Swan, radioman Peter Lafata heard that Japanese drivers were making milk deliveries with radio transmitters concealed in the cans to beam in the raiding planes. Mrs. McCrimmon heard that it happened at Kaneohe. Private Sidney Davis heard that it was Hickam where the milk trucks went, and they drove up and down the hangar line knocking the tails off planes. Lieutenant George Newton also heard it was Hickam, and that a warrant officer shot the milkman when he boasted, "Well, I guess we Japanese showed you." Radioman Douglas Aker heard that the sides of the truck dropped down and Japanese machine gunners sprayed the field. Other rumors described how the local Japanese had ringed Oahu with white sampans, presumably to show the pilots that they had the right island. Additional reports told of arrows cut in the cane fields, helpfully pointing out the last 20 miles to Pearl Harbor. Under the circumstances, Corporal Maurice Herman wasn't surprised when all communications failed at his infantry outfit's command post. Along with everybody else, he supposed Japanese saboteurs had cut the wires. A careful check uncovered the break right next to the command post itself. A soldier pitching a pup tent had needed a piece of line and cut it out of the unit's radio coil. Worst of all was the report that 5th columnists were poisoning the water. At Ava, the post dentist spread a canvas cover over the base water tower, hoping to frustrate the saboteurs. Others heard that it was too late for preventative measures. The water was already contaminated. Mrs. Arthur Gardner, a Navy wife, tried in vain to find a way of explaining the development to her thirsty 2-year-old. 15-year-old Jackie Bennett ordinarily didn't drink much water. Now she was never thirstier. Storekeeper H.W. Smith heard the rumor after he had already quenched his thirst. He became violently ill and thought what an inglorious way to die for his country. They were quite clinical at the Hickam dispensary. Lieutenant Colonel Frank Lane had Saliva, the hospital's mascot dog, nailed up in a crate, then gave him a pan of water to see what would happen. The experiment failed when saliva wouldn't drink. As the day wore on, people grew too thirsty to care, drank the water anyhow, and, of course, with no after effects. In all the excitement over spies and fifth columnists, almost everybody forgot about Japanese Consul General Kita. Soon after the attack started, reporter Lawrence Nakatsuka of the Star Bulletin went up to the consulate to get Mr. Kita's comments, but had little luck. The consul simply said he didn't believe there was an attack. Nakatsuka returned to the office, and as soon as the Star Bulletin's extra was run off, he went back to the consulate with a copy. If it wasn't adequate evidence, it might at least be a conversation piece. Meanwhile, AP correspondent Eugene Burns tipped off the police that the consulate might be worth checking. Robert Shivers, the local FBI man, was urging the same thing, having failed to interest the Army or Navy in the matter. It was around 11 o'clock by the time Lieutenant Yoshio Hasegawa, the ranking officer of Japanese ancestry, got underway. He arrived with two carloads of men to find Consul General Kita lounging around the backyard in slacks, with reporter Nakatsuka still trying to get his story. Hasegawa and Kita entered the consulate, and other police trailed along. Smoke was coming from behind a door, and somebody asked if there was a fire. "No," Kita replied vaguely, "there is just something in there." The police opened the door and found two men burning papers in a washtub on the floor. They stamped out the fire and managed to salvage one brown manila envelope full of documents. The tour continued, and behind another door they found three or four men getting ready to burn five burlap bags of torn papers. Hasegawa posted guards around the place, confined the staff to one room, arranged for the files to be turned over to the FBI and the Navy. He also asked Kita and the other Japanese the same question that reporter Nakatsuka had found so fruitless. Did they know there was a Japanese attack on? No, they said solemnly, they didn't know. By now, there was time for some of the formalities of war. At 11:15, 72-year-old Governor Joseph E. Poindexter read his Proclamation of Emergency over KGU. His own voice trembled badly, but perhaps with good reason. One anti-aircraft shell had already exploded in his driveway. Another pursued him to his office, bursting in a corner of the Iolani Palace grounds. As the governor wound up his address, a phone call came through from the Army. "Get off the air. Another attack was expected." The governor's aides complied with startling vigor, seizing him the instant he finished, rushing him down the stairs, into his car, and away. The bewildered old man thought he must have done something very wrong on the broadcast and was under arrest. In line with the Army's order, both KGU and KGMB went off the air at 11:42. This was done, of course, to prevent enemy planes from beaming in on either station, undoubtedly a sound precaution considering how useful Commander Fuchida had found the local radio. But the silence only added to the misery of the service wives, huddled in their homes, lonely and afraid, longing for any news. Most of them kept their radios on, listening for the occasional orders that still came over the regular stations, or to the harrowing fifth column rumors that poured out over the police radio. Many of the wives were more than ready when formal evacuation of the Hickam and Pearl Harbor areas began at noon. The plan had been worked out long in advance. Buses and carpools would take everyone to the University of Hawaii, the various public schools, the YWCA. From there, the evacuees would eventually move in with families in safe areas who had volunteered to take them. Now the plan was underway. Loudspeaker cars rolled up and down the post streets, bellowing out instructions to get ready. At Hickam, Mrs. Arthur Farner struggled to load her five children into the family car. But as fast as she packed them in, they would squirm out and run back to the house for some favorite toy. Finally, she was ready, but just as she started off, 10-year-old Dan came running out, nearly left behind when he made a trip back for his swimming medal. At Schofield, Major Virgil Miller's family faced a different problem. A Chinese GI had been sent to their house to tell them where to go, and the Millers weren't taking any chances. Fearing he was a Japanese soldier in American uniform, they made him shout his instructions through the locked front door. Some didn't wait for formal evacuation. When the planes strafing Pearl City discouraged 11-year-old Don Morton from searching for his brother Jerry, their mother lost no time. She just scooped Don up in the family car and set out for the landing where the boys had been fishing. There was no traffic, but she kept honking the horn anyhow. It finally stuck, adding to the general din. Near the landing, Jerry emerged from the algaroba bushes and climbed aboard, A Marine corporal had pushed him to safety just before getting hit himself.